I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, so these are weird times, right? The news is tough, the mood is super tense, politics is a blood sport, and it's just like every day is just a freak out waiting to happen. So we wanted to take an hour and focus on some ways to take care. To take care of ourselves and to take care of others, to practice self-care as individuals and as communities. So today, we're gonna have a little tea time. a serious tea time, actually, with some really special tea leaves. The writer Ruth Reichel tells us about a place for people with disabilities where really good food is medicine. We'll have America's Test Kitchen on too to talk about some good small things you can do to take care of yourself and your family. Now, even as we thought about putting this episode together as a break from politics, the truth is that taking care of ourselves and others have always been connected to politics. I mean, you might even say they're at the very heart of politics and activism. Cecile Richards is one of the most powerful, accomplished activist leaders of her generation. She helped her mother, Anne, get elected governor of Texas. She was a labor organizer for migrant women, and she was the president of Planned Parenthood for over a decade. And she's a serious cook. So what do all these things have to do with one another? So hey, Cecile, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you.
I'm so excited to talk with you. And I want to start, actually, I'd love to start with actually the author bio on the cover of your book. Because I'm reading it and the last line of it is, she spends most of her free time baking pies. And I was really struck by it actually because it brought to my mind all these moments from the past where I remembered powerful feminist leaders seeming like they felt like they need to distance themselves from quote unquote domestic things like cooking. And so what has changed, do you think, that leads you to think, yeah, the third thing I want people to know about Cecile Richards is that I'm a hell of a pie baker.
Well, I wish I'd given it that much intentional thought. And it probably just says that I don't have a lot of hobbies, right? So pie baking sort of as a default became something that, that I love to do, my kids love to do. And I think the older you get, the more you like to find things that you share with your children. We have a sort of annual Thanksgiving, almost pie bake-off. But I also, I grew up in Texas, and it's a place where food and having people over and cooking together was just such a big part of my upbringing. It was that was the culture there, which is very different from New York City where I live now, where it does seem like most people use their stove as a place to store extra, shoes that they don't have room for in their closet. So it's funny. I feel like it's one of those things I've carried with me no matter where I've lived, is that a kind of a love of cooking and entertaining, if you will. It wasn't until I came to New York City that I realized people actually had other people come and cook in their apartments when they had dinner parties. I still haven't gotten over that. Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, it is weird.
It's very weird. That no one helps you do the dishes in New York because I guess they don't do them.
It's like not even built into the polite culture. It's like, what are dishes? Right. Don't they just disappear? Don't they go back into the rack and get rolled away?
Yeah, exactly, I guess.
But you didn't actually get into baking pies growing up at home, right? You actually learned to bake pies while you were organizing workers in a small town in Texas. Tell me about that.
I became an organizer, started organizing garment workers right out of college and women who were earned the minimum wage, basically were working along the Rio Grande border. And also, they didn't have any money. I didn't have any money. This was like really, really a super grassrootsy work, which I've done most of my life. And so cooking was sort of one of those things that you could do and have people over. I think it was a way of making friends and building community. One of the places I lived was Tyler, Texas, which is in Deep East Texas. It's more like the South than it is really the Southwest. And one of the most amazing pie places I ever had been was Cox's Grill, where you could get pie for breakfast, which I just thought was the most amazing discovery. And it wasn't even that the pie was great, but it was plentiful, and it was just something people did. And so I think I kind of got hooked.
Yeah. Let's talk about pie for a minute, like literal pie. Butter, shortening, or lard?
I'm sure I'm going to like break a lot of hearts out there, but I am an all butter woman, and I've tried it all. My favorite crust recipe is from Tartine, my favorite bakery in San Francisco.
They're amazing.
They are, and honestly, you just I tell all my sort of nascent pie bakers, folks who are just trying to learn, like use this recipe. You cannot screw it up, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where I am, all butter.
Yeah, actually, I think butter is great because.
Oh,
you know, it has a little bit of...
I knew I liked you. I wasn't really sure what it was, but it just immediately I felt this chemistry. Yeah.
Another butter person. Well, I mean, I love lard.
Yeah.
Totally. And shortening, you know, is fine. I mean,
it has its
lardish.
Role. It has its role.
But butter is great because it has a little bit of that water content. So when it bakes, it steams and actually puffs a little bit.
Yeah. No, I'm kind of glad butter's back.
Okay. But then filling.
Yeah. I'm a big fruit pie person. I like a good lemon meringue. I'm a big pecan pie person. I spent many years in New Orleans, and I can cook almost everything that you can eat in New Orleans and would for the rest of my life. If you're on a desert island and could only have one meal, what would it be? And it would definitely be a big New Orleans feast. I especially like cherry pie. I mean, also, like, who doesn't like pie? I'm sure there is someone. I may have even met someone, they just didn't have the heart to tell me, but I feel like it's just one of these great bonds you can make across the aisle, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean.
I haven't really tried that yet, though.
At your next congressional hearing.
There we go.
Hearing,
I'm going to say, like, before I start, maybe everybody would just like a little bit of this cherry pie.
Yeah. So right now, we are in a super intense moment. Maybe an existential moment in our politics.
Yeah.
You are obviously very busy because of that. This is sort of a weird question to be asked because we asked you on to our food show, but does it feel, does it feel trivial in this moment to be talking about baking pies? Like, should we?
I mean, we're all human beings. We have to live through this period. And I actually think it's really important that we retain our humanity now. And one of the things that has been interesting to me, I feel like people are recognizing that at a moment in which particularly the message out of some politicians is so divisive. And that I really think just speaking about fellow human beings in ways that seems to just dismiss their very existence or their right to exist. I think it's really important that we have other things that can begin to bring us together. One of the things I have felt so strongly and why I'm sort of traveling around the country now talking to women is I think we haven't been listening to each other very much. And I think a lot of politicians are, they're telling us what we should believe. They're not really listening to people. And I think that, you know, cooking, meals, eating, sharing food is something that is so basic to our humanity. And I think folks are kind of retreating to some of these really tried and true methods of being people together. So I love it. I think it's really important. And probably the most special times of my lifetime are when I remember being around the table with whether it was family or friends and cooking and enjoying food together. There's something that is just a common thread that runs through all of us.
Yeah. And I think eating with people is powerful emotionally. But I also think there's something particularly special about feeding someone. I'm a semi-new dad. We have an
congratulations.
Thank you.
We have you're going to cook a lot of meals in the
that's exactly it. But like we don't go out, right? Like
no,
we're at home, and so I've been cooking so much more, just like daily food instead of like cool project food or whatever. And what I've also begun to feel in such a powerful way is I've never felt important in my entire life until I started like feeding my daughter and knowing like the act of my cooking this food and putting it in front of you and watching you spoon into your mouth, like that's keeping you alive right now.
Right.
And there's just something so profoundly human and humane about that experience of cooking for people.
Right. No, it's so, so satisfying. And, it's reminds me of this, one of the things that, that I do with my kids and my husband is every year we try to go someplace we've never been. And last Christmas, we went to India for the first time because we'd been trying to wait till we had enough time to really spend a couple of weeks. And one of the last things we did was we went up to Amritsar on the border, and went to the Golden Temple. A friend of mine, her family's from there, and we went and served at the Golden Temple kitchen, which is this free kitchen where they serve thousands and thousands of people every day, and it's almost completely volunteer run. You basically can just show up. So we did, and of course, no one there really spoke English, and we didn't speak any Hindu, any languages that were being spoken. I remember sitting next to some women who had traveled for 2 days to get there, all across India, in order to serve. And we sat there and we rolled roti and we served people. And it was absolutely, bar none, the most incredible experience my kids have ever had in all of our trips. It was felt like we were in this community, and people welcomed us, and they just made a place for us. And anyway, it's something I'll never forget, but it is. It kind of speaks to what you're saying. This, the basic act of feeding others and being in service to others through food is really, there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that, Cecile.
Thanks for my gosh. It was, I'll never forget it. One thing though, I should tell you, since you're a new dad, I didn't realize that. this is just one of my rules, which is, at least I said, before my kids left home and went away to college, there were three things they had to know how to do. One, deep fry, because this is a dying, it's a dying art. I think, for us Southerners, they absolutely had to know how to make a good pie crust, which they're all more than capable of doing. And the third is be able to fry a tortilla into a good chalupa, because that's another thing that just too few people in America really understand.
I love that the three things you made sure the kids knew, like two of them were deep fry related.
Hey, well, you know what? You'd be surprised how many people you're going to meet in New York who don't know anything about deep frying. It's a crime.
No, this is actually a legit thing, because I never deep fry at home.
And I just invite me over. You know what? I think I could give you some tips.
Ryan, thanks so much for coming in, Cecile.
Thanks for having me.
Cecile Richards' book is called Make Trouble: Standing Up, Speaking Out, and Finding the Courage to Lead. And after hearing her talk about pie, if you feel the urge to start baking, we put together a list of some of our favorite recipes at splendidtable.org. And coming up next, I take my first taste of a tea that my grandfather left me when he died.
Some tea's been through really bad times, and they actually tell the story. And some teas, when you drink it, all of a sudden you want to cry. Mm. Some teas, you drink it, everybody was on the floor. Right? So it really tells the story. It's alive. So it's like drinkable antique, and it's alive.
That's Tim Xu, a Chinese tea expert. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters, and I'm your host, Francis Lam. If we're talking about taking care of ourselves, probably the ultimate cliche is making yourself a cup of tea. Right, you warm yourself up, you stir in some honey, you have some sympathetic chit-chat. It's always late afternoon, and the lemon yellow light is filtering through onto your tablecloth. Well, when I met Tim Xu, a Chinese tea practitioner, as he calls himself, it was a really different scene. First, we had to meet him in an undisclosed location in Chinatown, New York. He led us into an unmarked door, we went down these dark stairs, and then we were in this basement pleasure palace, where there were shelves full of insane wines and a humidor full of cigars and a fireplace. And it was like, I swear, I was half expecting some pet tiger to start walking around. But I was there on a mission, because one side of this place was his tea room. And there was this gorgeous stone table carved around the edges so that water can run off. And he had this hot water kettle set up and this collection of beautiful, delicate porcelain cups. And I had an old Folgers jar full of Chinese tea that my grandfather had left me. So thank you, Tim, so much for having us today.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
So this doesn't look like a whole lot. As you can see, this is...
That's a lot. That's almost a pound of tea there. If it's over, it could be $40,000. Yeah. Go buy a car!
Who knows what it is? This could be $1 million pound of tea.
Right.
But this was an old Folgers jar, with the red plastic cap. I wrapped it in aluminum foil just so
light won't get into it. I don't know what this tea is.
Okay.
I know that my grandfather, so my grandfather grew up very poor. And in the last third of his life, in the post-war boom in Hong Kong, he made money. And after he made his money, he devoted so much of that money to eating well and feeding his family well, the foods that were important culturally that he never had access to before.
Right.
And he became a connoisseur of food and drink. And at some point before he died, he bought this tea. A very old pu'er. Okay. I don't know how much of it. I don't know its provenance. I don't know how old it is. I don't know if it was naturally aged or if it was cooked. Mm-hmm. But he bought it, and it was a big deal that he had it. And after he died, the family split it up. And so this is my inheritance of my grandfather's tea. So I've had this tea since 1994. He passed away in 1994. I've never drank it because I've never known how to honor it properly.
Okay.
And I've never known how to appreciate it. So I want to bring this tea to you today.
Oh, us.
For us to taste it together.
Thank you.
For me to learn about what I've inherited.
Do you know when he acquired this?
I don't know. My father might know.
Mm-hmm.
My father's memory is terrible. My father literally doesn't know his own birthday. But he might know when my grandfather bought this tea.
Okay.
This tea has been in my possession for 24 years.
Let's investigate. This is a glass jar, and you actually store it really properly. I hope that you clean the Folgers coffee out first.
Yes.
Okay. And can you open it? Can you probably open it first? Okay. So a pour usually comes in a cake.
Yeah.
It's called pour cake.
Right.
So this is actually a break up of a cake.
Mm-hmm.
So when he bought this, he bought it loose.
Right. Or it's possible that my family, when they were dividing it, broke it up.
No. This is professionally broke up.
Okay.
Because if me and you breaking up a cake, it would be ugly.
Yeah.
This is very, very, you can see that.
The leaves are very separate.
The stem is there, the leaf is there. They're not in big chunk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. It's pretty old, just the smell of it. What you do is, do not be scared. What you do is, you breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, keep your nose inside. Just feel it. It's like almost like a memory. Like, think about walking into one of those old rooms with mahogany panels all the way up in the ceiling. Just think about that space, and when you breathe into it, you can basically smell a little bit of memory in it. This is all about memories. Okay.
It smells, I mean, I can't tell if you influenced my image now, but it smells to me so much like really beautiful old wood.
Yes.
It smells a little bit like leather.
Old furniture, wood furniture that the Chinese use.
It has a tang to it. It has a little bit of a high note to it. It's not just that old.
But it's almost like powder-like. There's a little bit of talcum. There's a little bit of hint of roses in there that have almost like ji fun in Chinese word. It's like almost like cosmetic.
Hmm.
The grandma that used to put their face talcum on their face,
uh-huh.
The white powder,
yeah.
It have a taste and smells of that, if you think about it.
Hmm.
For me, just smelling it and looking at it, this could be a Mang Hai factory. This is basically a recipe cake. The recipe cake start from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and really died down on the Cultural Revolutions because everything kind of stopped. So it smells like a Mang Hai tea cake, which is a company in China that makes pu'er. There's four companies that makes pu'er. Mang Hai is one of the biggest. Just because of the stem and leaf ratios in that jar.
Like that's indicative of their style?
The style, the smell is their style.
Mm.
The look is more like, okay, what kind of grade it is, what kind of taste they want to create in it. It's like clothing. A Gucci, a H&M have their own distinctive looks. So
sure.
That's what it is. So basically we have, right now, we have less than maybe 6 grams in here. Okay, and I think that's sufficient enough.
Okay.
This is a nose. This is a device that you display your tea and you smell your tea, same as what you just did in it. But this is passable.
Oh, this is a beautiful little bowl you have.
This is basically your edges. Yeah. This is like your nose. Like
yeah, it's shaped like a nose. Yeah.
So what you do is you bring it in, and you breathe in and breathe out 3 times, and you can pass it down, and you can by breathing in it, you can see it, you can look at it, you can understand a little bit of it. So this method is using porcelain instead of earthenware to taste a tea.
Okay. So you just filled a porcelain teacup with a lid with some hot water.
So this is called gai wan or goi wun in Cantonese. Mm-hmm. Gai means lid, wan means bowl. Yeah. So it's basically a lid bowl. You actually pour hot water in it and you heat it up first. It's already clean, it's just a ritual.
So you just put this heat into this small, heated, lidded bowl.
Right.
And now you have these small white porcelain cups. Mm-hmm. Is the color important?
Yes, this is more pure in white. It basically shows you what the tea color is. Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to kind of mask what you're really looking at, because we want to test the tea.
Yeah.
We want to see the true color of the tea. We want to investigate what this tea is and actually see what the tea can tell us a story. And to do that, you always want to give an environment that is very neutral, you know, and very respectful. It's like drinking a good bottle of wine that you need to have the right glass. So you want to bring the little bowl in closer to your nose. Use the lid to kind of shield the aroma inside, and you just turn it and you smell it. So when you're doing an OT tasting, you want to do maybe one third of tea and then the rest is water. So the next thing we call is called rinsing. We all have to rinse our tea.
Okay.
So what we do is we pour in hot water over it in a rotation that we kind of cleanse it a little bit. Okay.
So you just pour the water into the side of the cup and it hits the very edge of the tea, and then
so you create a vortex in it, in a way.
So right away he just strains the tea out.
So you don't wait. You basically you rinse and you let it out. So what we call this stage is the tea is prime. It's ready to make now. So what you immediately want to do is you want to smell it.
It smells old.
Old books.
It smells like,
it's
like
old
people.
Ivory.
Yeah. It's making me dizzy, but I can't tell. It's because I keep just like breathing in air like super hard.
You have to understand this point. We're drinking something rare. And tea is a very specific thing because you will get tea drunk with this tea. Because there is something called cha qi, which is tea energy. Mm-hmm. The older the tea tree live, the stronger it gets. There's something more than just a taste. There's something more, it's like a memory. Mm-hmm. There's something that is almost like a smell, you just hit you and you're like, okay, I remember I have smelled this once and now it's bringing me back. It's all about that. It's all about what we've been through, because the tea's been through that too. Way older, right? So think about it as a person, it's been through a lot. Some teas been through really bad times and they actually tell the story. And some teas, when you drink it, you all of a sudden you want to cry. Mm. Some teas, you drink it, everybody was on the floor. Right? So it really tells the story. It's alive. So it's really alive. It's like drinkable antique, and it's drinkable, it's alive.
So now this is the first.
This is the first brew. All right. So you haven't drank this tea before?
No, never.
All right, moment of respect in here. Thank you for bringing this tea to us. And thank you for sharing this knowledge and treasure from your family. So what we want to do is kind of divide this into three slurps. And slurping is extremely important. It's not impolite, it's actually polite. What we want to do is aerating it. It's almost like having a wine tasting. I will demonstrate it first. So what you do is then you follow that water down your throat, and then you breathe with your mouth. And that's a full one taste, okay?
I can feel it in my ears.
Yeah, I can feel it in my cheeks. So traditionally we call the first brew is the aroma of the tea. The second brew that we're going to do is called the body of the tea, which is more of what it's enhanced in the inside of it.
So the technique you're using is, like you said, two-thirds water, one-third tea, and you don't steep it, really. You're basically pouring the hot water in and then pouring it right out.
What we're doing here is just peeling the onion layer by layer because you want to taste each layer separately. And this tea probably go up to at least, I would say just right now, it will go up at least 60 to 70 times. I think today we're probably going to, if we are lucky enough, we're probably going to drink for the seventh cup. And I'm very lucky to have moments like this. You know, someone have something that is doesn't know what it is, but they know that this is my history, this is my heritage.
Yeah.
And then we share it, and it's like, okay. And this is very spiritual in a way for me. Thank you again. This is amazing.
Thank you so much for taking me into the journey of this tea. I don't know if it's the tea or if it's just I keep thinking about my grandfather and how he died almost 25 years ago and how I've held this gift from him for that long. I've never had the opportunity to, you know, have him come back into my life and touch me through it. And so thank you so much for being here to help me do that.
No, thank you.
Tim Xu is the founder of the Mandarin's Tea Room, and, you know, we sat there and drank that tea together for almost an hour, with each little cup tasting different than the last. The same tea. He told me that a really good tea can last for dozens of steeps, where, you know, you're making like we were, just rinsing the leaves with hot water, and each cup is tasting the flavor layer by layer. And this really interesting thing happened, because by making and drinking the tea this way, you know, we were committing ourselves to really tasting it, to sipping it and thinking about it, and then identifying and naming the different flavors wasn't some show-offy competitive thing like, oh, look how good my palate is. It was just a way of slowing down, of being still and focusing as intensely as possible on this one small thing. And then it became about just connecting with your senses and just letting the moment take hold. And it was like a meditation, and I came out of it feeling like something really special had happened. And you can try it too. Just get yourself some really nice tea leaves. It doesn't have to be a family heirloom. Pack a pot with a bunch of it, pour a little boiling water over it, let it sit for just a second or two, pour it out, and drink it. Taste it. Like, really taste it. Slow down, do it over, and I promise you it'll feel like you're taking good care of yourself. As a writer, you never really know where the story's going to take you. Ruth Reichel writes a column for Town & Country magazine that's about special, delicious things. Now, usually they're about an obsessed baker's maniacal devotion to panettone or a peach from a unique farm in California, but this month she set out to write about prosciutto and ended up in a place that moved her beyond what she'd imagined. She's here to tell us about it. Hey, Ruth.
Hey, Francis. I was totally unprepared for, I mean, I went to write about Cesare Casella's prosciutto. Mm-hmm. And I have loved Cesare, who's a wonderful chef. And I followed him for many, many years as he had restaurants, Beppe, Marema. He was kind of famous for being the chef who had rosemary in his pocket always. And for being a generous soul. I mean, I think everybody loves Cesare.
Yeah.
And I heard about the fact that the Edwards Smokehouse in Virginia had burned down, and that
the country ham
people, and that it had left the farmers high and dry, because there were farmers who were providing the heritage pigs at a rate of 250 pigs a week, they were all going to go out of business. I mean, it was like, you know, it's a huge investment. You have a year's worth of pigs in the field, because you've got to raise them, and these are, you know, happy pigs who are raised beautifully. Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the one buyer burns down.
The one buyer is gone, and Patrick Martins, who's the head of Heritage Foods, who had brokered these pigs to the Edwards family, was kind of desperate. Mm-hmm. And he called up Cesare and said, you know, can you take some pigs this week? And Cesare was making salume. Mm-hmm. And Cesare just instantly said, you know what, I'll take them all for the rest of the year. I'll start making prosciutto. And it was
like
just...
thousands of pigs.
Thousands of pigs, 250, you know, a week. And it's wonderful prosciutto. And so I thought, well, I'll do this for my column. And Cesare said, why don't you meet me at the Center for Discovery? And I said, what's that? And he said...
I mean, that sounds like the name of a place, like in a comic book.
Exactly, like, it does. And it's in very rural New York in Sullivan County. And I got there, and it turns out to be a facility for severely disabled people. It is also one of the most beautiful and inspirational places I have ever been.
Huh.
They have hundreds of acres. The housing for these people, many of whom are really severely autistic. Mm-hmm. There are people in wheelchairs. There are blind people. There are people of all ages. There are 1,000 people who are in this facility. Mm-hmm. And they live not more than 5 or 10 people in a house. Mm-hmm. And the houses are lovely. And they all work in some way on the farm.
Oh,
so
wow.
they raise every kind of animal you can think of, you know, pigs and chickens and cows. They have horses because horses turn out to be very good therapy for certain disabled people. So they actually have a way of hoisting people from their wheelchairs onto the horses.
Yeah.
So here we are in this beautiful place. And Cesare says, Patrick, the director of the Center for Discovery, wanted food to be a basic part of the program. And they raise everything that they feed these people.
Oh. Wait, so this is like a hospital or it's like a lifelong sort of...
I mean, what would you call it? A ranch? But it's not like any facility for disabled people that you've ever seen before.
Mm.
And as one of the people who works there said, I mean, one of the things we realized is that people need to work. They need activity. So they have a CSA, and there are people who are, you know, picking and packing. Mm-hmm. They raise herbs. They make all kinds of herbal teas. Mm. There are people who clean the eggs and pack the eggs. They have schools there. They also have, for the people who work there, there are 1,500 people who work there.
1,500 people work there?
Yeah. Well, there are 1,000 people who are taken care of.
This seems like a small city.
Well, there is a nearby city called Hurleyville, and they have sort of bought up much of the town itself, the old movie theater, the cafe, the newspaper. They really involve all the local citizens. So the whole idea is that they will be part of this community.
Yeah.
And this beautifully raised organic food is part of the therapy.
Yeah, and that they're also part of the growing of it and the production of it.
And it's just everything about the place is inspiring.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
My pleasure. Everybody should go visit.
Ruth Reichel is a living legend. The author of many books, most recently My Kitchen Year. She was the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine and writes a column for Town and Country. You can read her story about the chef Cesare Casella and the Center for Discovery in the October issue. Coming up, America's Test Kitchen's Tucker Shaw on the little things you can do in your kitchen to take better care of yourself. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, let's talk. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252, leave us a message, or you can add us at Facebook and Twitter. All right, we have Dan from College Station, Texas. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Dan, are you an Aggie?
I am not, but I do work for the university. I'm a Scarlet Knight and a Trojan.
Oh, well, hey, there you go. Well, I'm sorry to bring up your probably complicated feelings.
Okay.
I have never been to College Station, but I've always wanted to sit on a College Station porch because there's this great song called This Old Porch by mm-hmm. Robert Earl Keen about him and his buddy Lyle Lovett hang out on porches when there were students there. And it's just an awesome song. It's always made me feel like, I want to go sit on a College Station porch.
Yeah, it's pretty famous around here because Lyle Lovett comes to town frequently and gives concerts at the university and always plays it.
Oh, right on. That's awesome. Well, I'm sure you didn't call me to hear me talk about porches. So what would you like to talk about?
I would like to talk about feeding a 2.5-year-old.
Oh, man.
So we have a 2-year-old boy who
congratulations.
Thank you. Somewhat picky in what he likes to eat. And my wife and I are getting a little bit tired of eating the same thing over and over. So I was wondering if you had any advice for parents of toddlers.
Oh, man. Ah. So I have a daughter roughly around the same age. And, you know, that is the billion-dollar question, right? Like, if I had the answer to that, like, you wouldn't be talking to me on the phone right now. I would be sitting on a yacht somewhere, like, just earning royalties off my book, you know? Because my friends, certainly we, like, there's so much stress around feeding your kid, and especially at that age, where, you know, we were pretty fortunate in that our kids seemed to eat most anything we put in front of her. Not a lot of it. Doesn't always eat a lot. And that used to freak me out, too. Like, oh, my God, we're starving her. She's not eating enough. But she would eat, like, a variety of most everything we would put in front of her. So we were lucky, although we've always heard that, like, oh, that changes around 2 or 3. So you're not going to be lucky for long.
Right. The most frustrating part is that when we get his little daycare report card from school, he eats all of the wonderful, diverse meals that they make at school, no problem.
Yeah. No, totally. I hear that a lot, too. And, like, yeah, sometimes we have that with napping. Like, our kid naps a half hour tops at home. And then, you know, she comes from daycare, like, she slept an hour and a half today. I'm like, how does that happen? So I think a lot of it is social, I'm guessing. You know, they see the other kids doing it. They're going to do it, too, you know? And, you know, as for how to feed your child, I don't have, like, a magic formula. I don't have magic recipes. But I would say a couple things. One is, you know, eating together seems to really help. And I think part of it too is, like, you kind of have to let go of the stress of, oh man, if they're not eating that, we're going to starve them. So we need to keep giving them the same thing over and over again because we know they'll eat it. Because I think what that happened, that's probably self-reinforcing. And for us, like, we had to, like, sort of come to our emotional peace with that. But sometimes it means, like, if your kid is going to skip a meal, it feels so terrible, but they're going to get hungry and they're going to eat eventually. So maybe they skip that meal and they start realizing, hey, if I just keep skipping meals because I don't want to eat it, I'm not going to get a whole lot to eat. And they kind of come around to it.
You're exactly right. Yeah. As a parent, you know, I feel that I have to keep telling him just eat more, eat more, eat more, even though he has clearly, you know, decided he wanted to stop eating.
Yeah.
So it's stress for us, and clearly it's not stress for him, but it makes us feel like we're not doing it right if our kid is not eating everything that we give him.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other part of it too is, like, you get pretty sick of chasing your kid around the house with a spoon in your hand, you know, like, so some advice I've heard too is don't do it. Just don't do it. If they start walking away, then you tell them, okay, it looks like you're done eating, and you put the food away and they're not going to have the rest of their meal. And they know they can't do that anymore. And again, you're not starving them. You're just helping them learn, oh, meal times are meal times, and it can't just be do whatever you want. And in terms of, like, actual foods to serve them, you know, my thing is I've always wanted to make sure that our kid ate a variety of foods. Like, I wasn't so stressed about, like, is she eating enough of this? Is she eating enough of that? And don't, like, accede to dumbing down for them, right? Like, cook the food you want to eat for yourself and, you know, make them a portion that fits in their spoon, that fits in their mouth, and, you know, they'll come to it. And if they don't like it, if they actually actively don't like it, then you know that, right? But if it's just like, oh, I don't feel like it, or I'd rather go play with my Play-Doh, you can kind of keep giving them the food and they'll figure it out. I hope. I don't know.
Yeah, he doesn't actively say, I don't like that. He's pretty talkative. But I guess our biggest problem is that he just wouldn't eat. And I assumed it's because he didn't like what we were making, but I think your advice of you don't want to eat, then okay, don't eat. And eventually he'll learn to eat at mealtime because otherwise he's going to be hungry following that.
Yeah,
I think that's,
yeah. And not like, yeah, not do it as like a punishment. Like, okay, fine, you're walking away. This is what you get. Not like, just like, this is the natural order of things. You know what I mean? Like, oh, are you done eating? Hey, you're telling me you're done eating by walking away from the table. Okay, we're going to put away the food, you know? Because I don't think it's about power dynamics.
It feels terrible as a parent for him not to eat.
it's the most miserable thing.
I guess every single parent feels the exact same way or has been through the exact same thing.
It is the most miserable. And honestly, the thing that really helped us too, like it helped me emotionally, is like, you know, you take them in for their 6-month checkup or whatever, and the doctor's like, she's growing fine. Look, right here on the chart, she's growing fine. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I don't need to freak out the next time you don't eat because you've done that in the past and you're still growing, so it's fine.
Awesome.
All right, well, good luck. Like I said, I'm only giving you advice I've heard, and you know, there. I think parenting is one of the strangest things in that everyone feels like it's so hard and everyone feels like they don't know what they're doing, and yet, like, oh, our species has continued to survive for a long time. So, like, the babies kind of figure it out and they kind of grow into humans, so it's fine.
Despite our worst efforts. Or our best efforts, but feeling bad about it.
Yeah, exactly. Despite our constant incompetencies. Cool. Well, thanks so much for the call, Dan. Good luck.
Oh, yeah, thank you. This was good to hear that we're not doing it wrong.
I mean, you might be, but I might just be doing it wrong the same way you are. All right, talk to you later.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right, bye.
And hey, we always love to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. America's Test Kitchen is back, and this week, our friend Tucker Shaw talked with Sally Swift about some thoughtful ways to take care of ourselves in the kitchen.
Hey, Tucker, great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sally.
So, Tucker, we have been thinking about what it is to take care of yourself. And one of the things that I kept thinking about when I was thinking about talking to you is the rituals that we have in the kitchen and what makes you feel like you're in control in the kitchen and what makes you feel like you're taking care of yourself. And one thing that I'm just going to use as an example is, for me, I am settled and happy and feel taken care of when I wake up in the morning and I have put out a clean dish towel for me to use. And it's such a small thing, but it makes such a difference to me. Do you have things like that that you think about in the kitchen?
Well, that's a really good question. And I love your example because it really represents sort of a moment of intention. And it sounds like a small thing, but if it makes you feel better when you wake up in the morning, I say go for it. I've been thinking about ideas that maybe take a little bit more effort. And my top tip for sort of taking better care of yourself in the kitchen is to reevaluate your spice rack. Get rid of everything that is even remotely old and refresh it, because there's no way to make the results of your cooking more flavorful and more exciting than if you use fresh spice.
Yeah, spices go old way quicker than I think we want to admit.
It's really true. And when you buy them at the grocery store, although you can often get a pretty good product, you're buying a set amount. And honestly, there's no way you're going to use that entire bottle of ground clove before it's gone, you know, sour. So I think the best move is to find a specialty spice shop in your area. And failing that, look for grocery stores that cater to Latin American ingredients or Middle Eastern ingredients and so forth, maybe South Asian, because you will find generally smaller batches available to you, and also just better quality, and refresh them often.
If you're going to cook, you might as well really cook, right?
I mean, go for it, right? I mean, you put in the effort. You want it to taste good.
Exactly. What else do you have?
So this one is a little bit more indulgent because I am slightly obsessed with butter. The thing about butter is there is a huge variation in quality, even of the stuff that you buy at the grocery stores. So I think for a little sort of gift to yourself, next time you're at the grocery store, buy a better quality butter. And what I'm talking about is a European style or cultured butter. And you can find these often in, you know, that little island in the grocery store that has the specialty cheeses or meats or things like that. That's usually where it's merchandised. And it will generally have a higher fat content and maybe a slightly tangier flavor. But when you slather it onto a piece of toast or a muffin in the morning or a dinner roll at night, you will not believe how much better it is. Now, it's going to cost you a few bucks more, but it's worth it.
Okay, that's a good tip too. Anything around equipment or tools?
Yeah, and this one is really personal to me because I just did this. I have been frustrated with the kind of lackluster performance of my nonstick skillet recently, and I realized that I probably had it for 4 or 5 years, and honestly, nonstick surfaces really don't last forever. You can't look at this as you would like a cast iron skillet or something like that. You gotta replace your nonstick skillet every year, maybe 2 years, depending on how heavily you use it, if you want kind of the best performance. And I, after consulting our tastings and testings group, and they chastised me for hanging on to my old one for so long because I'm such a cheapskate, mm-hmm. they said, go out and buy our new favorite. It's a 12-inch nonstick skillet by OXO Good Grips. And I think it cost me about $50, maybe a couple dollars more than that. And honestly, Sally, it has changed everything about my evening sort of routine. I barely have to clean it anymore. And it's completely worth it. Do it every year or two.
I hate that they are disposable, but they really are. That coating really goes. And because most of us aren't very careful, truthfully, when we work with our nonstick skillets, we overheat them, right?
We
scratch them up.
And there's really no way to fix it yourself. So
yeah,
you just got to bite the bullet.
Anything else?
Okay, so here's another one that goes into the self-indulgent category. And you've heard this before, but I just want to reemphasize it for everybody. Build a relationship with somebody at a local wine shop. I'm telling you, it will change your mind about how you consume wine, how thoughtfully you consume wine. It will really expand your knowledge and understanding mm-hmm. of what wine can offer. I really look at wine shops as kind of like libraries, in the sense that when you walk into a public library, there's no way that you know the collection as well as the librarians there. So you need to really sort of, to make the most of that library, you've got to have a little consultation. Same goes for the wine shop, especially small local wine shops. They can help you make a decision. Now, they could steer you wrong. That's a gamble. But honestly, how bad could it be? It's wine. You're going to
drink
it. Well,
that's right. You could steer yourself wrong so easily. You might as well.
Exactly.
You might as well give it another shot. Do you have any thoughts about recipes or cooking for yourself?
So this one is a little bit bittersweet on my side. My grandmother died maybe 2 years ago, 2 years and change. And before she died, she lived a very, very long and full life. But she entrusted me with her box of recipes. And they weren't all her own original recipes. They were sometimes scrawled down on a note card, you know, borrowed from a neighbor, occasionally even clipped off the back of the box of a cereal box or something like that. But going through those old recipes really brought back a lot of memories and also sort of opened my eyes to some mysteries about her kind of cooking behavior and the foods and ways that she cooked. The best was when she'd have like an index card that said something like, you know, Mrs. Johnson's mocha brownies. And then, you know, Graham's little notation would be like, yeah, they were so-so, you know, really honest. But cooking these recipes, which are not nearly as sort of well communicated as most mm-hmm. recipes that you'll find, you know, in magazines or cookbooks and so forth, they're really sort of like cook till done, that kind of thing. So it can be a gamble, but it's so worth taking. And honestly, if you're able to create something that, even if it doesn't match what your beloved family member was able to achieve, mm-hmm. kind of gets you close, it really feels good.
Oh, Tucker, I love that one. And you know what? That's your grandmother taking care of you.
I think about her every day.
I love that. Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor-in-chief of Cook's Country, and he left us with a recipe to put that good butter to use. Check out their butter fan rolls at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. Thank you, as always, for spending a little time with us. Until next week, let me leave you with some words from the activist and civil rights lawyer, Florence Kennedy. You can't dump one cup of sugar in the ocean and expect to get syrup. If everybody sweetened her own cup of water, then things would begin to change. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. If you'd like more on anything you heard here, go to splendidtable.org. You can take a look at our recipe collection, sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcast. The newest in our feed is Splendid Table Selects, and it's interviews and stories that have inspired us, taught us something new, or just made us better cooks and eaters. Find it all at splendidtable.org. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director.
Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And thanks this week to Sylvie Lubow for recording us with Tim Hsu. And as always, thanks to the great crew at the Marketplace Bureau in New York, Sarah Bruguer and Dan Powell. Sally Swift is our managing producer, and I'm Francis Lamb. Take care of yourself. This is APM, American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.